Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Lee Boyce today is Angharad Carrick. And coming up, don't mess with our cash ISAs. Lee Boyce takes aim at all the speculation around cutting the tax breaks for the popular savings product. Octopus becomes the first energy firm in Britain to launch an investment platform to raise money from customers for renewable projects. What are the risks? With council tax set to shoot up again from April, we look at who has to pay and what happens if you refuse. Ang spoke to Virgin Media's O2 customer service boss about their pledge to turn around their poor performance. And why does living in a hard water area make energy bills more expensive? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, the government is desperate for growth. Billions of pounds are parked in savings accounts, especially cash ISAs, a whopping 421 billion, in fact. Money that some city bosses have argued to the Chancellor recently would be of far better use to everyone invested. Better returns for us, it's good for Britain, and yes, good for city bosses and financial firms. So what does Rachel Reeves do? Cut the tax benefits of cash ISAs has been one suggestion. But our Lee is far from convinced. If you haven't, by the way, signed up to the This Is Money newsletter, please do. Never has a piece of writing about a news outlet style guide been so passionate or riveting. Welcome and welcome, Lee. Firstly, where did all the speculation come from? What have been the suggestions, Lee? What has got you hot under the collar that, honestly, I felt like I was really getting into your psyche when you were talking about the reason behind the way you've been writing ISA, even.
I love that you called it riveting and magical about magical. ISA, the acronym, individual savings account. We don't cap it up on This Is Money. We cap up the I and lowercase S and A. And we do get quite a few readers email in saying ISA should be capped up. But for us and for me in particular, I think ISA has become a word. It's become something that people are just used to saying. And as I say in this column, we don't say ISA like we say USA. We say ISA. We write about ISAs a lot, and people really care about them. A lot of people are using them to their full potential. So what's happened in the last couple of weeks? I'm going to just start this by saying this is all speculation. There's nothing at the moment to say anything is changing, but speculation is pretty rife. And it is alleged that the Chancellor had meetings with some city bosses who said, hey, cut tax breaks on cash ISAs. There's too much money parked in cash ISAs. It would be a boost to the economy. It would be a boost to potentially British businesses, etc. If more people were almost strong-armed into investing instead. So let's go a little bit back in time in the ISA. So we've had ISA since 1999 in the current form. Before that, you had something called a PEP, which was a personal equity plan. Lots of adaptations and moves and how ISAs work over the years. But probably the most significant one came around about a decade ago, where you could basically choose what you did with your ISA, whether you wanted to split 50-50 between cash and investing, a stocks and shares ISA, or you could move the parts as you saw fit. You could have 90% in investing, 10% in a cash ISA. Before that, it was a lot more kind of tightly run on how much you could actually put in a cash ISA. So what's happened is that you do get people, you do get savers who max out their cash ISA limit, currently at £20,000, has been at £20,000 for quite a long time. And actually in the budget document from October, there was actually a line in there saying that it would be frozen till 2030 at the £20,000 limit, which was quite unusual because usually in those budget statements, it would say for the next financial year to give the government a bit of headroom to muck around with it and do whatever it wanted with it. But it has actually put in the budget document till 2030. But of course, that can all change. Now, to go back a little bit closer in time, last April, the Resolution Foundation, left-leaning think tank, argued that ISAs are basically only beneficial to rich people. That was a kind of upshot of it. And they sort of muted a £100,000 lifetime limit. Any more that you save into an ISA would be taxed. Again, this was just a think tank putting a paper out, but you can see where the mood music could potentially shift. Now, what city bosses are arguing is there's too, as I said, too much body parts in cash ISAs. There's hundreds and hundreds of billions of pounds in ISAs. We've been pushed into using ISAs because we're so heavily taxed elsewhere. It's a savings product, a financial product, a rare beast that really fundamentally is quite simple to get your head around. Yes, there's been lots of sort of Frankenstein style changes over the years in which we've had lifetime ISAs, help to buy ISAs. There was a rumour of a British ISA when they were talking about launching that, and then that got binned off by Labour, probably rightly so, if I'm being quite honest. Outside of all that, the fundamentals are you've got a £20,000 pot that you can save into tax-free every financial year. And what's happened is naturally lots of savvy people have gone and maximised that. Yeah, not everyone could fill up £20,000 a year. Of course they can't. But there are enough people, that millions of people, that are using these in a way that these ISAs sort of start as a little, I had to describe it as a little baby. You have your little baby ISA and it grows with you as you kind of potentially get promotions at work and you get more disposable income and you've got more room to save. They become even more and more important, and your little ISA baby starts becoming a kind of toddler, then it becomes a teenager. And before you know it, you've got quite a big amount of money. You know, it's a fully grown adult. And it's been saved away, squirreled away from the tax man. I think that's really, really important. And I think if you start mucking around with what you can do with it and how much you can limit, how much you can put in a cash ISA, I think it just goes against what the product is all about. But there is method in the madness, right? I do think that some people potentially see a stocks and shares ISA as risky. I don't want to invest. I don't want to, my hard-earned cash. I don't want to risk it. So one part of me goes, well, come on, you've got to take some risk. You know, yes, cash ISA rates look quite good at the moment. You can still get 5%. But over the long term, investing is always going to be a cash account. We only have to go back a few years and you look at cash ISA rates from a few years ago, you know, sub 1%. You know, it's very, very likely that you're going to beat, over the long term, 5, 10, 15 years, you're going to be a cash account. But the other part of me goes, but it's people's choice, isn't it? It's called an individual savings account. It's up to the individual to choose what they do with the money. If they want to park it in a cash ISA and potentially run the risk of it being eroded away by inflation and not growing as much as it could in a stocks and shares version, that's up to them. Isn't it? And we had someone write in this week saying, I've got £254,000 in cash ISAs. At first I said, whoa, hold on, that's a lot of money to be holding in cash ISAs. But the person that wrote in didn't tell his age, what he's got in pensions, his aversion to risk, all of that kind of thing. I don't know the individual circumstances. Maybe they got burnt investing in the past. All of those kind of things. But it's up to the person to choose how they use their ISA. So personally, Georgie, I use my ISA 80-20. So 80% of my money that I put away every month. This is after doing all of the other things, saving into a private pension, making sure the mortgage is being serviced, etc., etc. But I split it on the whole around about 80-20. So I have 80% in a stocks and shares ISA, 20, and 20% goes into a cash ISA. I use the cash ISA almost as a break in case of emergency type thing, which is much easier now with flexible ISAs, which allow you to dip in and out. But I think it's all speculation. It's going to be very difficult to change. The person that wrote in about the £254,000 pot was worried about being taxed retrospectively. I mean, that would be very harsh and very difficult. And I really think that I just can't, it'd be just too hard to implement. I just can't imagine that it could work. But the one thing I'll sort of sign off and say on this is we put a poll on the website. We've got new fancy polls on the website at This Is Money, and we put in a question: should the government make people switch savings out of cash ISAs and invest instead? Now, I should also add here that This Is Money readers, our podcast listeners, are probably in that savvy bunch that do invest, and they probably do also save as well. Probably similar to what I'm saying, an 80-20 split. You might do it your own way in a different, but broadly speaking, I reckon a lot of listeners and readers do that. But it said here, So the top answer, this has had 7,521 votes. I mean, that's a pretty sizable pool. Okay, it's a hyper-focused pool of people because it's people that have come to read about Cash ISAs and ISAs in general on our website. But 83% of them said no, let people make up their own minds. 13% said encourage them, but don't force anyone. 2% said yes, savers will end up better off, and 2% said don't know. But that encourage them, but don't force anyone. I think that's, to me, probably the solution. You know, it's just about financial education. It's about cluing people up on how easy it is to get going if you want to open a stocks and shares ISA, and the power that it can have. And actually, there were some stats this week that Vanguard put out. Now, of course, Vanguard have got, you know, a kind of self-inflicted interest in this because they're offering fundamentally investment products. But if you look at, you know, broadly how they did this research, they went back to 1999 when ISAs in their current form kind of launched, and they looked at what you would typically, if you had £10,000 in cash without touching it or doing anything to it, the return now, you'd be sitting on £18,695 roughly. And then if you had it in a, they looked at FTSE All World total return, £77,826 in the same time frame. Now, if you adjust it for inflation, which is the real danger of holding all of your pot in cash, is that actually the spending power over the 26 years falls to less than £5,000. Investments rise still to £65,000 over the period. And that does illustrate the power of investing. It also illustrates the power of time, compound interest, and how important it is to have a kind of long-term sort of outlook if you are investing. And the reason why I say that is because when you look at this chart, after 5 years, so in 2003, the cash return is actually at £12,578 and the investment return is at £9,535. So you do get rough years. You do have rough spells when you invest. You are not guaranteed to definitely outperform cash over the short term, but over the long term is where the key of this all lies. Now, is anything going to change? Is anything going to happen? We've seen the government making, I would argue, tough choices and tough decisions. They haven't shied away from doing things that have been unpopular. You know, you only have to look at the winter fuel allowance and taxing pensions, putting the pensions into inheritance tax wrappers. I mean, it's kind of, they're making these kind of decisions. So could it happen? You can't rule it out. Is there any kind of concrete evidence that this is definitely going to happen? I'd argue not. And I'd argue at the moment it is just speculation, and it's kind of like watch this space, ..
Well, I'd argue probably everything's on the table right now. Ang, look, while this presumably would be very good for Britain, good for, as we said, financial firms that would get a cut of all this, you know, Lee also pointed out that it would potentially be good for us. You know, we covered recently on the podcast and on your website, you know, 25 super ISA investors in the country who have an average of 8.9 million saved in those accounts. I don't think any of them would have got there with a cash ISA. So, as Lee said, you see method in the madness. And actually, ISAs were never as generous as they have become now. So why don't we just kind of revert back to the olden days?
Yeah, I kind of think if you're putting money in an ISA, you want it to grow. So I'm not as pro-cash ISA as I think Lee is. I think, you know, everyone should have the choice. You shouldn't have it taken away from you, which I think, you know, potentially the government's going to do. But I just don't understand why anyone would choose to do that. I mean, you know, obviously there are maybe people in retirement that it works for them. But those stats that Lee said, I mean, I just don't understand why you would kind of part your money, especially kind of if you're a little bit younger, why you'd part your money in a cash ISA. But I get, you know, ultimately it is about choice. And I think, you know, taking it away is not a good thing. But I don't know if I'm anti lowering that tax-free allowance. I don't know if it's a good thing.
Ooh, controversial. We like that, though, on the podcast. We like differing opinions. There's one thing that I would ask, though, that we've always said, and Lee, you've certainly said this, is you can never guarantee the government will keep things the same, essentially, whether that's pensions, whether that's ISAs, any sort of saving thing. What can you do? I'm sort of channeling our sponsors here, but, you know, what would you be advised to people I suppose, don't keep all your eggs in one basket, or, you know, because the government can change the rules as they see fit, when they see fit, unfortunately for people. And that really throws up our plans for the future.
It does. I think it's just about stability. And I think that's what ISAs kind of bring. You know, in the savings world, they bring stability. We've got a personal savings allowance that's been frozen since 2016. You know, if you're going to start tinkering around with ISA limits, you're going to have to look at potentially raising the personal savings allowance for tax on savings accounts, basically on your savings interest. You know, that personal savings allowance should potentially, or would have to potentially move. I would argue, but that, again, that comes with it its own kind of set of risks and problems. And then I think that we've been encouraged to save into ISA for such a long time, especially high net wealth individuals, you know, people that earn over a certain amount, that you kind of, we've got used to putting it in there. And you touched on those super investors, you know, to have almost £9 million, you know, shielded away from the tax man, you know, that's through savvy investing and being a savvy individual. They've played the system how it's been created, and then they've just maximized it to its full potential. We can't moan about that if that's how the tax system has been built. You know, and what can you do right now? Well, it's just keep with your same plan. Keep doing what you're doing and making sure that you kind of use your ISA allowance to the full potential before the end of this tax year, which is in April, and then for the next tax year as well. I should also point out here that a lot of people, this doesn't affect. You know, you can save outside of a cash ISA without being taxed, because lots of people have small pots of savings. They don't have vast, huge pots that, you know, you're going to get potentially taxed on the interest for because you busted your allowance. Should point that out. A lot of people actually don't necessarily need to be in the ISA wrapper, but we still think that ISAs are a good product to This Is Money. And the reason for that is because circumstances change. You know, in the future, you might come into some money either from, as I said earlier, job promotions, or, you know, get more disposable income. You might end up with a payment from inheritance or something like that. And these kind of tax-free homes for your money are vitally important. So it's very hard to start moving the goalposts, I would argue. Yeah, I think £20,000. I actually wrote last year that I thought £20,000, I wrote a sort of throwaway line almost, that £20,000 is a generous limit. There were lots of readers in the comments saying it's not a generous limit. It's been frozen this way for like 8, 9, 10 years, which goes to show, I think, that there's no pleasing everyone. It's going to be very difficult. It's a difficult position to try and please absolutely everyone. I mean, I personally thought it was quite generous. I think £20,000, when you compare to yesteryear, as you said, you know, it was never always, it's not always been that generous. You know, I remember first writing about ISAs when I first started that This Is Money 15 years ago. I can't believe I just said that out loud. You know, and the limit was like £5,000. I don't have an intrinsic knowledge of ISA limits in my brain that you might expect, but I'm pretty certain it was around about that, and no more than half of it could be in cash.
It's interesting, Lee, that you said about how this doesn't actually affect that many people, because if you take a look at the statistics of, you know, firstly, how many people max out their annual allowance, and I think it's about 7%. And you mentioned £100,000 as potentially being a cutoff point. Only 2% of ISA savers actually reach over £100,000 or have over £100,000 in their account. So really,
but at the moment, that's a crucial thing.
Of course, at the moment, and wealth builds, etc., etc., etc. But I would suggest that the vast majority of people will not be affected should the government bring in measures like that. But that's not to say that Lee can't get upset about it, and we have the right to choose, etc. And it is frustrating. And this is where I think it annoys me the most is what I said earlier, is that people have plans. They've made plans for the future. And now they're writing to you really concerned about what's going to happen to those plans. That is a frightening place to be.
Yes, I think it naturally is. It's a cornerstone for a lot of people's personal finances, you know, private pension and then ISA. I think that's naturally where they kind of look to save. And that's where I was sort of mucking around a little bit earlier about having your baby that turns into a toddler. To a teenager that turns into an adult. But that's kind of how ISAs do kind of grow and move with you, with more flexibility than a pension. So why would we go now start moving the goalposts when we kind of always been encouraged to save and to make sure that we have enough emergency savings to make sure that we've got enough in the future? I think that you start moving the goalposts on what has been one of the most successful British financial products of the last few decades. It just erodes trust. And listen, there's a massive cohort of people that do not have rainy day savings funds. You know, completely different subject area. You know, one hand you've got people that are kind of tucking away money into ISAs and squirreling away money from the tax man. And on the other hand, yes, you do have people who are completely not in this boat. Wouldn't even know probably what an ISA is, you know, because they've never had to use it. For those people, to encourage them to save, something completely different is needed for that cohort of people. And things have been tried in the past, you know, but it probably would make more sense to resurrect an idea to help lower income people save, because the real fundamental issue with lower income people saving is, of course, not having enough disposable income to save in the first place. But even if they do have a little bit squirreled away, if you're saying, even in a regular saver, which we're fans of here, because you can tuck money away that snowballs into something far bigger, hopefully in the future, if you start saying to them, you're going to get 5, 6, 7% on this money, small amount over the course of the year, and you look how much interest that is, a lot of people just go, what's the point? You know, that's not enough interest to, you know, get me anywhere near interested in saving. So that's different. I think a different argument, and it's a different thing. ISA saving is very much about people that are kind of, you know, tucking away money for kind of potentially retirement, that's more at arm's reach. You know, all of our pension age is getting pushed further and further away, and to have the flexibility of having an ISA that you've potentially got at arm's length that you can tap into if you potentially don't want to retire at 70 or whatever it is that we're going to get pushed to our generation. You can see why. And I can kind of see with ISAs as well. It's, you know, inheritance tax, we say 4% of estates are affected by it. It looks like that's gonna only grow over the next few years. But people, we call it the most hated tax, and people sometimes don't like it that we call it the most hated tax. But you know, there has been surveys and polls that suggest it is not a very popular tax, even though lots of people aren't affected by it. I kind of feel the same about ISAs, and I think people would get quite upset if there was quite a lot of tinkering, even if it didn't properly affect them yet. And I think that's the crux of the issue.
Quite. All right, then, we'll leave that to one side and we'll keep you posted if anything changes and anything becomes more than just speculation. But Octopus Energy is certainly keen on investing. It's become the first energy company in Britain to launch a retail investment platform. Now, it will give customers the opportunity to own a share of its renewable projects for as little as £25. It's targeting a fundraise of £1 million for two wind turbines in Yorkshire and in Wales. Ang, tell us more about this, if you would.
I have to say, it wasn't something I was expecting to see in our inbox. Octopus Energy basically have launched this new investment platform to give their customers and retail investors the opportunity to own a share of a wind turbine. And you can invest as little as £25. It is a bit of a weird one because renewable investments are not what you'd go to for retail investors. They're incredibly risky. The yield from the kind of projects are really, really unstable. But I think the key thing that Octopus Energy has said is they're targeting a 6% yield, which is pretty decent. But if you don't get that kind of money back, or you know, there's potential to obviously lose your money, they're going to reimburse investors. So it's a pretty good deal, but you are investing in wind turbines, and I mean, it's incredibly risky. I'm not entirely sure why a kind of average investor would look at it, just because of that risk. The key thing about it is it's regulated by the FCA, but it's a restricted mass market investment. So that essentially means that you have to kind of pass a test. You have to be a sophisticated investor, which is kind of someone that works in financial services, high net worth. So you've got to earn over 100K or have 250 grand in kind of net assets, or a restricted investor, which is essentially you can kind of only invest 10% or less of your assets. So it's niche. It's definitely not for everyone. I'm
I'm
not.
sensing you're not sold on this.
I'm
I mean,
not. I'm
I'm
not.
just getting that vibe.
No, I'm not. I think Octopus Energy, I'm a fan of them, but I think they're kind of going into investment. I think it's a bit of a odd move.
It's quite a big move. Do you know what I mean? Like, surely, and look, I am no expert in business, but 1 million doesn't sound a huge amount. Surely they could just go out to the sort of, I don't know, the market and say, hello, can you give us a million? Why create this whole platform thing?
I think it's part of their kind of brand, though, isn't it, Georgie? Like, it is a bit of a cult. It's a bit of a cult. You know, people are kind of like, they're quite octopused if they're like an Octopus Energy customer, because I think they like all of the kind of fancy ways that you can check on your energy bills and all of that kind of stuff. They're a very tech-heavy first energy company compared to anyone else. I mean, their platform Kraken is, you know, really where they service all this. It is an impressive thing that they've built from scratch, and it's why they're so kind of nimble, and it's how they've managed to make customer service fairly seamless, considering how many millions of customers they've hoovered up out back of Bulb collapsing, buying Shell Energy customers, all that kind of stuff. So £1 million for 2 wind turbines does not sound a lot. The platform is called The Collective, which I think probably, I mean, it sounds like a Netflix series, The Collective. You know, 6% return. They put in an example, £1,000 would own you 0.05% of a turbine and would own you 180 quid over 3 years. That's what they've kind of put out there. And as Ang says, you know, they have put this kind of guarantee that if it doesn't deliver returns or whatever, they're going to pay you back. Now, it's not guaranteed that if they launch more of these, that would definitely happen. Also, the big kind of thing to consider is 6% sounds fairly impressive, but you can get 4 to 5%. Let's go back to our friends of savings accounts. You know, you can get 5% savings accounts, you know, return. So for an extra 1%, is it worth it? But I think really what this is tapping into, Georgie, is people that like Octopus as a brand. And I think it's tapping into people that want to be feeling like they're doing good in the world. And renewable energy is a very hot topic, and it's very polarized. There's a lot of people that would say no more wind turbines. They're ugly. They're, you know, taking over the countryside, and we should be looking at other ways. And then you'll have other people saying wind's the future, we live in a windy country. And actually, I think the very last word I'll say on this is that Octopus is a big company. You know, this isn't just some sort of fly-by-night company that's offering this. Then we would be kind of like more red flags, and you'd probably be looking more of a 10, 12% return, because it's some company you've never heard of, and the risk is far, far greater than it is if you're then going with a company like Octopus that, at the moment, they literally doing what they say on the tin. They seem to have tentacles in absolutely everything and anything.
Ba-dum-bum.
Dum.
Well, do you know what? It's funny, Lee, because I am actually an Octopus customer, and this goes to show how often I log onto my account. Although I think this all looks rather new. So I've just come on here, and apparently you can even go to the Octo Plus shop, Shoptopus. You can get all sorts of things. You can get a Constantine the Octopus small toy. You can get a Puptopus toy for your little dog that squeaks. I mean, my
God. Oh, Georgie, you've been hooked in by the dog toy, haven't you? they do. Like, I've got friends that they absolutely love it. There's some sort of reward scheme, isn't there, as well? I think if you've got a smart
baby romper,
I think you get Octo
Point. Yeah, you do.
Yeah. And like, he tells me, oh, we're going to go and get a.
You spin the wheel.
Whatever shop it's linked to. We're going to go and get a free Octo coffee. And I'm just like,
yeah.
Okay, cool.
I've only just worked this out, although mine have said they're all gone, sadly. But yes, you can get all sorts of things here. It's marvellous. I can get, you know, harvester discounts and everything. Anyway, we go on. Final word to you, Ang.
I wouldn't, personally. I think, you know, if you're that interested in sort of renewables and all of that, I mean, there's loads of kind of funds and investment trusts that have been doing this for years and years, and maybe you've been sucked into the kind of Octopus cult, as Lee says. I'm an Octopus customer. I think they're good. I think they can just get on with supplying my energy. I don't think they need to be dabbling with investment.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Dan Beecroft from Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Dan, topical question this week. I have an ISA, but it's all in cash. Where do I start if I want a stocks and shares version? The floor is yours.
Hi, Lee. Well, firstly, it's important to understand there is a significant difference between the two. So let's start with cash ISAs. You know that your money's secure, it's not going to decrease in value. If it's a fixed rate account, you even know the exact amount that you'll have when it matures. On the other hand, the stocks and shares ISAs come with way more risk. The value of your investments will fluctuate, there's no guarantee future value, and it could go down. However, the long-term argument for stocks and shares ISAs is that investments tend to outperform cash over time. So if you're willing to set your money aside for, say, 5 years or more, and can tolerate some volatility in your investments, then switching to a stocks and shares ISA might be a smart move for you. In terms of steps, firstly, you need to find a provider. So you want to be looking for a low-cost provider, large choice of investments. You want to check if you're planning to do regular contributions, that the minimums that they take will be suitable for you, and the sort of trade costs and stuff like that of buying and selling the investments too. Once you've found your provider, your platform, you want to open a stocks and shares ISA, that goes without saying, and then you'll have an option to transfer in. So you can either request a physical form. Most providers have an online portal where you can type in your cash ISA provider, reference number policy, that type of thing. And it's all automated. Probably takes a couple of weeks for the money to transfer across. And once it's in your new stocks and shares ISA, you do actually need to invest the money. A lot of people will transfer the money and leave it as cash, thinking it's going to be automatically invested. Normally it isn't. You have to pick your own investments. If you're new to investing, I'd perhaps start by looking at low-cost multi-asset funds or tracker funds. At Charles Stanley Direct, we do offer stocks and shares ISAs. We have a low-cost platform and a wide range of investments to choose from. If you're unsure where to start as well, beginner investors might be interested to book a free 15-minute coaching call that we offer. You can do this via our website. Just search for Charles Stanley Direct Financial Coaching. Usual risk warning supply. So the value of investments can fall as well as rise. Investors may get back less than originally invested.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Dan. That's Dan Beecroft from Charles Stanley Direct.
Welcome back. Millions of us will have to pay even more council tax from April after the government gave the green light for rates to be increased by as much as 9%. Last week, six councils were allowed to raise council tax above the usual 5% threshold. Now, in response, some taxpayers have taken to social media to say that they plan to not pay. While tempting, Lee, is it wise? Firstly, council tax, who has to pay? Where does it go? Why has it got so high? Because it is enormous.
Yeah, councils are in trouble. A lot of councils are in trouble and having to ask the government for way bigger rises than what they usually would ask for. Usually it's capped at 5%. You can get special permission to rise it by more than that. Windsor and Maidenhead asked for a 25% rise. They got 8.9%, but some other areas of the country, Bradford 9.9%, Newham also 8.9%, Birmingham 7.5%. These are the rises that are coming in that have been okayed. And as a result, some households are upset. I think that council tax has gone too far. There's been this movement on social media talking about council tax strike, where basically you just cancel the direct debit and don't pay for it anymore. Very dangerous road to tread. Very, very dangerous. Something like it's got a take of something like 97%, or you know, it's a very hard tax to kind of dodge. There's exemptions, there's single discounts for single people, all those kind of things. But you can see that there's a bit of a tipping point, I think, with council tax, and people are getting fed up with the constant rises, the services that are potentially not improving alongside it. You know, it goes from everything from bin collection to libraries to, you know, all sorts of things. But people, I think, it's starting to push to a point where they feel like they're not getting value for money. But if you just cancel your council tax, you are honestly at risk of basically being...
Go to jail, can't you? I mean, many people do, but you
can. So Ang wrote this story, and we tried to go off and find how many people actually get put in prison every year for council tax dodging. And all we could find, really, various reports. We dug into all sorts of government reports and things, it sort of says around about 100 people a year go to prison for failure to pay council tax. So about two a week. I think what they're saying is if we cancel it en masse, then how are they going to put us all in prison? But I mean, honestly, it's one of those kind of like daft social media things where it's like, all I would say is that, you know, there's one thing about being upset about, we've talked about this in the podcast, especially over the last 12 months, that feeling of we're just being taxed and taxed and taxed and taxed and taxed and taxed some more. And council tax is another tax that doesn't directly come out of pay. So you think about how much we get taxed from our pay. And then it's all of this additional stuff that we kind of have on the periphery. You set up your direct debit to the council and it just comes out every month. And you kind of almost I forget about it in a way sometimes. Mm. You know, it kind of just goes out of the account. But, you know, if you have a quick look around on the social media, people are not happy about some of these rises. And I think this is, again, a topic that's only going to grow. There's so much deficit. Yeah. These councils ask for more, bigger rises than what they were permitted to actually do, but are still way beyond that 5%. But on the flip side, it's if they don't do these rises, the council say they're going to go bankrupt. They're going to declare themselves bankrupt, and it's messy. It's really, really messy. The council tax system has become difficult to kind of understand where your money's going, and understand how these councils are going bust. And you add them to get together, and then the maths you're getting out of that is angry people on social media. And in general, I'm fed up with it. I just think, more council tax rises. What's changed? What's different?
What's getting better for my money?
Yeah, you know, why hasn't my town turned into some sort of utopia with all of my council tax money?
Yeah, exactly.
but also, you know, there are pressures on the council, you know, adult social care, things like that. You know, there's lots of things bubbling away that are kind of, it's expensive. So I understand it. You know, it is expensive to run a town, an area, and all that kind of thing. It's all of the stories you read about kind of the waste of where money goes on certain projects that you might not agree with, and you go, my money's being spent on what? Like, I just want the schools to be good. I want the hospitals to be good. I want no potholes on the road. I want the town to be nice. You know, stop making businesses leave premises because of high business rates and all that kind of thing. You know, there's so much wrong in this country in that kind of way. And this is sometimes how it manifests. It bubbles away, you know, and social media now makes it very easy to, you know, I was on social media. This is where I spotted this, actually. I just saw someone saying, I'm not paying my council tax. I've cancelled the direct debit, and a screenshot of it. Then I found myself down a rabbit hole of lots of people doing the same. And I thought, okay, this is dangerous.
This is a story.
Yeah.
All right, then, talking about people who are not very happy. Well, Virgin Media O2 customers, they know all too well how frustrating dealing with telecoms giant can be and having complaints about it. But now the company, often top of regulator Ofcom's most complained about companies list for broadband and mobile, is promising to turn things around. And you spoke to customer service boss Alan Stott. What did he tell you?
Yeah, so spoke to Alan Stott, and it was an interesting conversation because it's at the top of the most complained broadband and mobile, which is quite a feat. They've basically not been doing a great job, and they kind of, in the last year or so, basically said something needs to change. Kind of to go back slightly, obviously, Virgin Media O2, they kind of joined forces in 2021, and apparently that was kind of the issue. It caused a lot of kind of tensions, two very big brands, but two very, very different systems. And apparently that's the reason why everything went wrong. I'm not entirely convinced by that explanation, because I think there were issues pre the merger, but apparently that was kind of the biggest reason why they've kind of topped the list. So they have been spending £1 million a day to kind of get on top of customer service issues. You know, investing in call centres, chatbots, AI, technology, all of that kind of stuff. And it seems to be working. I mean, yesterday's Ofcom complaints data showed that they are kind of getting better. They're still not great, but they are getting better. And I think the key thing that Alan said was, while they're investing in AI and kind of tech and, you know, partnered with Amazon and all of that stuff, they are really, really keen to kind of keep up that kind of human contact. So chatbots and all of that kind of techie stuff is that they're really not going down that route. I'm not 100% sure whether that'll be the case in kind of 5 years.
For now. Yeah, for now.
They kind of said they're not investing all of this because of financial performance or losing customers. They've lost a lot of customers in the last year. And I think they're probably getting a little bit worried about that. So, I mean, it was really, really refreshing to actually hear someone say, you know, chatbots don't actually work. And we understand that customers like to speak to a human. And it was really, really good to hear that. But I think we are going down that path. I think almost, you know.
The technology would be so much better as well. That it's and actually, the more I hear from the next generation, the more they don't actually want to speak to people. So maybe they're going to have to go that way.
Yeah, I don't understand. Like, I just need to speak to a human because I just think speaking to a chatbot is honestly one of the worst things about 21st century. It's just frustrating. It's really, really easy. You can have a 20-second conversation with someone and it will be sorted out. And I think that was, you know, their whole sort of thing is you're spending less time dealing with complaints if you're actually speaking to a human. So, I mean, it seems to be working for them. It is a lot of money. $1 million a day is a lot of money.
Mm. Yeah, Octopus could do with that. They only need 1 million, don't they? Right, dripping taps, leaking pipes, faulty appliances can all add to your monthly bills, but there might be another less obvious reason why you're paying more. So if you live in an area with hard water, usually in the southeast because of the chalk and limestone in the region, apparently, it could be adding to your energy bills. Lots of talk about water bills going up. Also, lots of talk about energy bills going up. Lots of talk about all bills going up, Lee. And this is another way your bills could be going up. Why?
Bills, bills, bills.
I know, right?
Well, if you live in the southeast, especially limescale is what gets built up from the hard water. What it does is it gets into your pipes, it gets into your appliances, and it makes them a lot less efficient. And as a result, you should probably be using specialist stuff that can clear out your dishwasher, your washing machine. You should be getting your boiler serviced every year to make sure there's no build up around your pipes. But it's very difficult to keep a handle on. And actually, I've got a personal story about this. So when I went to get my hair cut a few years ago at my local barber, I suffered from psoriasis of the scalp, which is just a really irritating thing. But he said the big reason that I would have flare-ups probably is that this area has just got disgusting water to wash in. It's so hard, and it's not great for skin conditions. And I thought, actually, there probably is something in that. I went away, did a bit of research, and ended up getting a water softener. So I've got.
You should say you bathe in Evian or something.
Well, what he said actually really, he was like, just put a bucket outside. It rains loads in England. Just wash your hair with rainwater. I'm like, wow. That's going a bit sort of off grid for my life. That's a bit too much. I mean, think about that cold water. Just like, I'm not up for that. So anyway, I got a water softener fit. They're not cheap. They're about £1,000. And you have to replace the salt block every sort of 3-4 weeks. They cost about £6-8 a block. But it is night and day, the water quality for washing in. But that also circulates around the house in terms of, you know, the radiator system via the boiler and the appliances. And then we had a drinking tap put in, so you don't drink the salt water. You have just the normal water for your drinking water. But I've actually just thrown away the last kettle that we used because we weren't using the soft water tap. We were using the hard water tap, the drinking water tap, and we were clearing it out like every, you know, you have to descale it every sort of like, oh, it's such a boring job. I can't believe I'm talking about this on the podcast. but it just destroyed it. It absolutely destroyed it.
Yeah.
And it just shows you the power of it. So what the argument is that, you know, this could be adding a few £100 onto your annual energy bill, depending if you're in a hard water area or not. Someone was quoting £500 to annual energy bills. That feels really overcooked. That seems too high to me. But hard water does affect around about 17 million homes, it's estimated. And it's just really hard to tell whether getting something like a water softener has really reduced our bills. I mean, our energy bills are quite low, but I can't pinpoint that on having this water softener or because we live in a hard water area and it sorted it out. Very hard to know. But it's interesting. Think about how much damage hard water can do to your appliances and to your heating system and if it's making it not run as efficiently as it can be.
Indeed, Lee. Right. Finally, the winner of the coveted This Is Money mug this week is Rich. I'm just going to read the bit which massages our egos. First of all, let me say a huge thank you to the This Is Money team for the amazing podcast. I started listening in 2019. Wow. When I learned I was going to be a father, congratulations, and wanted to get my finances in order. The information in your podcast has genuinely helped me, and I look forward to listening every week. That's it for this week. We have a question as well. Lee, it's about raisins. I don't mean the savings platform either. I mean, literally, raisins. New raisins and the rule around the price increases. Lee, what's this all about?
Yeah, I like this. So this is all about shrinkflation. And this is why I picked it, because it's something that I kind of notice quite a lot. And it's quite a frustrating thing. So it's when, like, sneaky producers and whatever kind of put stuff in new packaging and make it look like you're getting the same what you were getting before. So here's an example here, about a brand that's basically used to pay £2.40 for 6 times 42.5 gram boxes. They're now charging £2.40 for 6 times 30 gram boxes, which means they shrunk the weight by nearly 30%, effectively increasing the rate by over 40%. It just feels like a scam. How can they reduce the weight by nearly a third and not tell you? They've essentially taken out two of the boxes, but instead of selling it as a pack of four, it's like they're lying by spreading them over six, trying to pretend nothing has changed. Obviously, I'm aware of shrinkflation. I know this is just raisins, but I'm wondering how many other products I've bought have had such large increases in their prices without realizing. Great email. Really like it. The shrinkflation stuff really does wind me up, Georgie. We're going to get a mug coming your way. And what I'd say is that I think that when something like this happens, a producer or whoever it is where this is coming from should have to have at least a 3-month grace period, which on the packet says this used to be this size and it is now this size for the same price, or some sort of way around it, because it's not on. And it feels like we're getting ripped off. One really quick example of this, and the reason why I picked this last week, if you're a parent, you'll know all about the little oat bars that kids love, all different brands of this little oat bars. I gave one to my daughter, 6 years old, on the table last week. She opened up the packet. I'm in the kitchen. I get a shout, "Daddy, daddy, daddy, come here." I go in thinking the world has just blown up or something mad's gone on. No, the bar had shrunk and she was holding it between her finger and her thumb. And she was, "Daddy, what has happened to this bar? Have you like taken a bite out of it?" Or they've shrunk the bar. They've shrunk the bar. I was looking at it going, either your hands have grown or that bar has literally shrunk. And it has shrunk. They have really shrunk them. So we see it in everything that we buy, and it's frustrating. So anyway, mug coming your way.
I was going to say, do you know what, for me, it's not just about shrinkflation. And I did try and do a bit of research for this, because he says that it's got new written on it. So I tried to look at the new compared to the old. Now, the reason I do this, and it might be slightly different with raisins, is because I follow this lovely Irish lady on social media who goes around supermarkets and checks all the ingredients. And it was a very famous hot chocolate brand who recently upped the sugar content, lowered the cocoa, which is obviously the more expensive element of it. Price is obviously staying the same. So I'm wondering if the new part of it relates to they have to put it, like, because the ingredients have changed slightly. And a lot of them are, we talked about this, you know, I think about a year or so ago, saying that it wasn't just shrinkflation, it was a change of ingredient inflation, whatever you'd call that, to make things, you know, a lot cheaper.
It's so true. You have to be so careful. And like, if I was a really boring person, if you've got like 50, 60, 70 staples that you buy on a regular basis in your shop, I honestly, it sounds really petty, but I would honestly be taking photos of the back and seeing what the ingredients are and if things change, because it's frustrating. And that's why I picked this email, Georgie, because it really struck a chord with me. I hate shrinkflation. I think it's one of the blights of modern life.
All right then, that's it for this week. You can keep up with all the latest breaking money news, just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Lee.
Yeah, you can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us on X, and you can also comment in the story which this podcast will live.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.